Well, we've all heard it, the power of positive thinking. But how does it work? Does it work? Up next, Mitch Horowitz joins us again. His latest, One Simple Idea, How Positive Thinking Reshaped Modern Life. We'll be back with Mitch in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. Mitch Horowitz was with me almost 2 years ago when we talked about his work, Occult America. We'll touch on that a little bit later on. His latest, One Simple Idea. It's all about positive thinking. And Mitch, of course, is a writer, publisher for many years. He's a vice president, editor-in-chief at the Tarcher Penguin in New York. And it's got to be very cold up there, Mitch, huh?
It is freezing here. A neighbor told me that New York City today was actually 13 degrees warmer than the Arctic, if you can believe
that. I got to tell you, my family's in St. Louis, and they got hit over the last couple days with what you're getting now.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it was unbelievable.
Yeah, we've actually got ice inside the apartment. I'm looking out my windows right now, and my six-year-old was asking me, why is there ice inside, Daddy?
I was watching videos all day of people throwing water into the air, and it was turning into snow, just like a ski rink, you know?
Yeah. It's been pretty wild.
Ice rink. It's crazy. Anyways, what's new with you since we last talked?
Well, the new book just came out today. It's the culmination of a lot of years of research into positive thinking and doing a lot of touring, a lot of talking, and it's been very gratifying.
How did you get involved in this era, this genre, Mitch?
You know, everything that I'm involved with today began when I was a kid. When I was young, my household, like many households in America, went through a financial disaster. We were in danger of losing our home. We were facing a very severe financial crisis. And at about age 13, I began looking for a piece of driftwood to hang on to. And I found my way to a wide variety of inspirational literature and classical literature, including the essays of Ralph Waldo Emerson, including some of the ethical books of the Talmud. And again and again, I kept coming across the idea that our thoughts have a concrete experience on our lives. This idea, George, runs through ancient philosophy, it runs through contemporary self-help, and I began testing the idea for myself, and I came to believe that it had truth, and that concept never left me, and that's been the topic of my exploration as an adult.
Nothing scarier for a little person, Mitch, than to hear his parents or her parents talking, arguing about financial mess.
Yes.
Disasters like that, and there's nothing the little kid can do in terms
nothing.
Of
and you're absolutely right. It's one of the scariest things a kid can go through, because your parents are like gods to you, and you view them as being infallible. And I heard a conversation one night where my mother was telling my father, we might qualify for food stamps. And kids all over this country hear that kind of conversation, and it's terrifying. And I consider myself fortunate that we emerged from that period. And I was able to emerge from it with a set of principles over the course of my life that never left me.
You know, my father worked at the Ford Motor Company in Dearborn, Michigan, nearly all his life. And, you know, I remember, Mitch, that he would buy things. If he wanted a new refrigerator and my mom wanted one, it would be cash. I mean, they didn't finance things in those days. And if he wanted a car, he saved up for it. And he went down there with a check and he bought that car for cash.
Yes.
And, you know, nowadays, everything is financed, everything.
Yeah.
And I think back at what he did and the things that we picked up from him. And he was always, he wasn't one of those boisterous, positive type people, but he had this feeling of being assured all the time. He knew where he was headed, never bragged about it.
Yeah.
But, he never had that black cloud over his head that so many people do now.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I think, in a way, we're going through a period of time where we're all going to need to return to those values. I remember many years ago when I asked my wife to marry me, she discovered I had something like $10,000 in credit card debt, and she said, I'll marry you, but not until you pay off your credit card debt.
smart lady.
Yeah. I mean, look, you know, and that's a pittance compared to what most people are functioning under. And it's not their fault, because we get this cheap credit thrown at us, and or at least we think it's cheap until a variety of factors kick in that are in the so-called fine print, and people find themselves underwater very quickly. There's too much predatory lending, and there's too much cheap credit, and I think, you know, the values that your father displayed are something that we all know that we ought to be doing, and we have to take those steps.
And it goes fast. I mean, you go shopping with a credit card. You could drop $1,000, $2,000,
yeah,
and you don't even know it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And one of the weird things in our society today also is that everything is so disposable. I mean, I feel like we go through appliances in this household that when I was a kid, we would keep for a decade or longer. You know, I mean, we have a refrigerator. We have a lake house in upstate New York. There's a Sears refrigerator there from the 1950s. It still works. It still works. And products just aren't made that way anymore. So not only are people spending more money as they cut their way through products, but these things, of course, create landfill. And it can be a mess.
Well, you know what? You're absolutely right. I mean, they don't make products like they used to. I mean, washing machines in those old days, those old Maytags,
yeah,
lasted forever.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. And if you look at a simple machine like a stapler, if you had a swing line stapler from the 1950s, the thing was built like a tank. You know, today they're made of plastic and they're practically disposable.
You break them. You break them just like that.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So when you talk about I want to do two things with you tonight. I want to spend a lot of time talking about your new work, One Simple Idea. Next hour, let's talk a little bit about Occult America.
And okay.
Then we'll take phone calls with you in the third hour. I'm going to keep you up very late tonight.
Oh, I'm all for it. I'm ready to go.
when you talk about positive thinking, what does that mean?
It really comes down to this. It's the principle that thoughts are causative, that what we think and what we continually dwell on has some authentic and concrete effect on our actual experience, not just on a psychological level, although that's very important, but on a concrete physical level. It not only affects what can happen to us in terms of our bodies, but also what can happen to us in terms of our actual experiences out in the world, our careers, our jobs, our relationships. And it's a wild concept because most people would agree, sure, you know, if you have a positive outlook, it's likely to make you a nicer carpooler, a nicer workmate, a nicer neighbor. Okay. And then some people will take it a step further and say, yeah, this placebo stuff is interesting. We don't really understand the mind's effect over the body, but clearly there's something there. I felt in this book I had to take it even a step further and say, this is a movement that's always seen itself as a metaphysical movement, as a spiritual movement that has held to the principle that our minds actually are a force, actually have some influence over our concrete daily experience. And I felt I had to hold myself to that standard and ask, is that true? And I came to believe that there's absolutely a shade of truth to that statement.
I had an old producer friend of mine in St. Louis. He'd come into work, Mitch, with a black cloud over his head.
Yeah.
I mean, he would come in saying, this is not going to be a good day. I'm not going to have a good day. And, you know, I kept chasing him all over the place saying, look, you got to stop doing that. I mean, that attitude is the reason why these things happen to you.
Yeah.
And how do you pull somebody away from that?
It's interesting. You know, we get pulled away from things when we feel we have something to gain. You know, there is a kind of healthful selfishness in human nature. You know, you'll find that sometimes people who are suffering from an addiction, for example, they really have to hit bottom before they can bounce. And in some ways, that's a tragic aspect of human nature, but in some ways, it's a survival mechanism. If a person can be led to believe that a certain mode of behavior is going to really detract from the quality of their life, from the quality of their experience, and they may need to actually go through some of that, they'll change. You know, I think sometimes the only thing that gets us to change is that question of survival. And if a person can be shown or can experience a shock that something that they're doing is really detracting from their lives and from their ability to be happy and to function, that may be the one agent of real change that we know of.
Can positive thinking change the outlook of an event and the outcome?
That is a wonderful question, and I wrestle with that mightily in the book, and my answer is a qualified yes. I don't believe thoughts are the only force that we live under. We live under many forces. We live under accident. We live under physical limitations. We live under mortality. We live under happenstance. There are a lot of laws and forces that we live under. As I see it, thought is one of them. It is one very precious, remarkable, and not well understood factor in our lives. So I wouldn't say that thought alone can determine the outcome of an event, but I would say it is absolutely a part of the recipe.
With positive thinking, concentrating, but you also have to go out and do it, don't you?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. I mean, it really has to be a kind of muscular positive thinking. You can't just be sitting in an armchair. Everything has to be engaged. The mind has to be engaged. The emotions have to be engaged. You have to be engaged in relationships that are nurturing. If you're working in an environment among people who don't believe in you, that's going to take a terrible toll on you. So the individual has to go out and do things. You know, my feeling is you have to approach life on all fronts, with relationships, with the mind, with the emotions, with opportunities. We don't need an armchair positive thinking. We need a muscular, active positive thinking.
You sent us a little mini doc on positive thinking that we have posted at coasttocoastam.com. You quote the late Ronald Reagan a
yeah.
lot. You like his, I guess, mindset, huh?
Well, I'm touched by Reagan's mindset. There was some kind of American optimism and patriotic optimism that Reagan was able to embody for large numbers of people in this country. Obviously, there are people who didn't like Reagan. They found him shallow. They found him superficial. But I was always touched by the fact that when Reagan was a kid, his mother imbued in him and his brother this sense of almost limitless possibility. And people would deride Reagan as a B-movie actor. In my view, he was nothing of the sort. He rose up from a poor background, and he did become a motion picture star. And when he shifted gears and he became a corporate spokesman for GE and then a conservative activist, I didn't agree with all of his principles, but he held them with such sincerity. And he would give speeches, and he would say to people, I don't mind repeating the same statements over and over because it's worth repeating something that you believe in. And Reagan was a model of self-belief, and he found the ability in personal circumstances or when he was facing personal difficulties to define himself in the strongest terms possible. So the man Reagan, the personality Reagan, I'm very interested in, and I developed an affection for as I was writing this book.
Well, I think he was a genius at what he did.
Yes.
I mean, when he applied himself, whether it was through positive thinking, his acting, his political career, it worked for him.
It worked for him. And there was an adaptability in Reagan. You know, people thought he was going to get us in wars and blow up the world. He wound up reducing nuclear weapons more than any other president in history. You know, there were interesting qualities to Reagan. He came into office as sort of a flinty cold warrior, and he left office as a kind of global peacemaker. And on topics of religion, Reagan could be very liberal. Reagan really imbibed a lot of different religious influences. We may talk later about Reagan's interest in astrology and other matters of the occult, but he was an interesting guy who drank from many different waters.
Mitch, what are we tapping into, this field of positiveness?
That, George,
what is that?
Is really the core question. We find these suggestions sometimes in medical science, in the placebo effect, sometimes in the quantum physics lab, that the mind has some shade of influence. Sensitive and persuasive people will speak to this in their own personal testimony. That question of what is actually happening, that's where this veil sort of separates us from the cosmic, from the unknown. It's very difficult to define what is a metaphysical force. We can find evidence of it, sometimes in ESP experiments, sometimes in brain biology research, sometimes in the quantum physics lab, sometimes in our own heartfelt and sustained experience. What is it? Is it God? Is it a force that actually a non-physical force that we have some possession over? It's very difficult to say, but I'll conclude this much. There is a non-physical dimension to life. There is something that goes on in life that has something to do with our perceptions, our observations, our sustained thoughts, that goes beyond the physical.
It's funny you say that. I'm doing part of a show tomorrow night on the Coast to Coast, and I take the position that there's life after death.
Yes.
But I'm asking a question tomorrow night, Mitch, and that is, assume for a moment there is no afterlife.
Yeah.
It ends when you die. How would you change your life? How will you live your life? if you truly understand and believe that there's nothing else over there.
Yes.
And what a cold, dark feeling that is.
Yes, yes. I mean, it's interesting. If you could really put someone in front of that question, some people might go in the direction of hedonism and say, well, then, you know, I'll just live and do whatever I want and hurt anybody I want. But I have a feeling that a lot of people would still strive to live some kind of ethical existence. I think we just can't believe that we have no connection to other people,
right,
that there's not something here other than flesh and blood.
I think people would generally stay the same.
I agree.
You know,
I agree.
The greedy people would stay greedy,
yes,
and the good people will be good.
Right, right.
You mentioned the physical end of this. I guess there's a twofold approach in terms of positive thinking, whether we tap into something that's out there,
yeah,
or is this merely a manifestation of the physical brain?
It's very interesting. You know, one of my heroes was the psychical researcher J.B. Rhine, who some of your viewers know.
He did Duke University,
wide variety of ESP experiments at Duke University starting in the 1930s. And Rhine just went through tens of thousands of trials tracking people who seemed to have some ability to get card images at a constantly higher than average level. So these people had some capacity of what he called ESP. And, you know, Rhine himself could never come to the conclusion what was happening. There was some non-physical transfer of information that was going on in his lab. And there were some individuals who were especially gifted at this non-physical transfer of information. So it seemed like it could depend upon the qualities of the individual, but Rhine could never really say, is it a force that comes from outside us or is it a force that comes from within us? But whatever the answer, and we may never know, it points again and again to the fact that there's more to life than just our flesh and blood.
Well, there's no question. There's something there,
yeah,
to be sure. And it works. If you're positive about something, I think the chances are highly likely it's going to happen for you.
Yes. Well, you know, you just used the key phrase, it works. And, you know, critics will dump on positive thinking and call it superficial and shallow and just foolish optimism or what have you. But my approach is, if it works, it doesn't matter what the critics say. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't matter what people like me say. You know, it's a practical philosophy. So in a sense, the individual has to try it for him or herself. If it doesn't work, don't listen to me, you know. But if it does, then it's irrelevant, whatever the critics say. Does it work is really the key question.
Stress kills.
Yes.
Is that almost like the opposite of positive thinking?
Yes, I think it is. I think it is. You know, it's remarkable. We talk about diseases like ulcers and hypertension, chronic back pain, chronic neck pain. These things almost always have a psychological dimension, and they can be treated psychologically.
Yeah.
There's a remarkable physician at NYU Medical Center, Dr. John Sarno, who uses what he calls knowledge therapy. When people come to him with chronic back pain or chronic shoulder or neck pain, and he finds that there's nothing organically wrong with them, he explains to them that this might be stress-related, and in a vast majority of cases, people experience extraordinary recovery, just knowing that this disease that they're suffering from could have a psychological component.
Stay with us. Mitch Horowitz with us. His book, One Simple Idea. We're talking about positive thinking. It does work. I'm George Norrie, and of course, we will be back in a moment right here on Coast to Coast AM. Have you watched our television program yet, Beyond Belief? Take a look at it. You'll like it. By the way, you can even go back and look at the interview I did with Santa Claus. They're all available to you. It's free for 10 days, by the way. Simply go to this website and sign up, beyondbelief.com. Welcome back. Mitch Horowitz with us. We're talking about his book, One Simple Idea. Mitch, at what point in your life, even though you're going through these, you know, crises as a kid, what point in your life did you start thinking positively?
Well, that's interesting. I started probably around age 13 or so. I remember I grew up in a traditional Jewish household. I had an Orthodox bar mitzvah. And after my bar mitzvah, this bearded rabbi handed me three books. And one of the books was an English translation of a Talmudic book called Ethics of the Fathers. And in Ethics of the Fathers, you really read just these very basic aphorisms about how to lead a good life. And the sages who wrote this book talked about the importance of having a good countenance, being cheerful, being a good neighbor, having a good name, controlling your anger. Again and again and again, they talked about the importance of right conduct and of greeting life with a certain degree of energy, of cheerfulness, of good countenance. And it struck me that, you know, these were principles that were coming to me from antiquity, from people who had struggled with very large ethical ideas, and they sounded at times a lot like what a guy like Norman Vincent Peale was writing about in The Power of Positive Thinking. And I began to discover these principles occurred again and again throughout philosophy, both ancient and modern. And it was at that point that I started to feel that our thoughts and our conduct, comporting ourselves with a certain degree of not just kind of an empty cheerfulness, but a neighborliness that made another person feel welcome, feel respected, really mattered, that it went deeper than it might at first seem.
We're human. We're subject to human conditions, ups and downs of life. Sometimes it's difficult to stay positive all the time.
It is. And actually, someone just this evening emailed me about that. And the truth is, we do go through dark moods. It's as natural as night following day. It's part of our makeup. When you're going through a dark mood, ride it out. Don't punish yourself. That's a time to just kind of take it easy, whether it lasts for a few hours or whether it lasts for a few days. You don't always have to be on the go, trying to hold yourself up to a high standard. Allow for the fact that our moods shift, our moods darken. I go through the same thing. We just have to take it easy on ourselves sometimes. Life is not always a matter of accomplishment. Sometimes we just have to go into a place of repose and let ourselves be.
Your first chapter, of course, To Wish Upon a Star, which I kind of played some bumper music.
Yes.
I've always loved that song ever since I was a kid.
Yes.
And to me, it's the epitome of thinking positively about making things happen in your life. You know, quit whining about stuff. Just get it done. Mm-hmm. And I think people need to do that.
Yeah. You know, it's we need to kind of approach life on all fronts. We need to try to be decent people in our conduct, not to make another person feel disrespected, not to make another person feel humiliated. We can all take a vow not to humiliate another person. We may not be able to control our moods, but we can control that much. We need to be active. We need to be physically active. We can't let ourselves get run down. There are so many fronts on which we need to address life, and we have to take every one of those opportunities.
Mitch, when you were putting together this book, did you come across any of your roadblocks, anything that you found difficult when you put it together?
Well, the thing that I had to wrestle with that was difficult is I came to feel that the positive thinking movement does have a flaw, and that flaw is this attachment to a kind of overarching law of attraction. You'll find some enthusiasts within the positive thinking movement who believe that the mind determines everything, that everything that happens to a person, whether good or bad, is a product of their thoughts. I don't believe that. I don't believe there's anyone listening who hasn't seen somebody suffer an illness or hasn't seen an innocent life snuffed out, even in atmospheres of love and hope and possibility. And we can't condemn entire societies, whether it's people in Haiti experiencing an earthquake or innocent men and women in Syria getting caught up in a civil war. Those people are not to blame for those tragedies. We live under tragedies too. We live under accident. We live under happenstance. There's violence that comes into the world sometimes. My contention is that the positive thinking movement needs to get away from this idea that we live under only one mental super law or law of attraction and deal with the fact that we live under many laws and forces of which the mind is one. So I think the positive thinking movement needs to reform itself. We can appreciate what's extraordinary about the mind all the better if we don't exaggerate it and if we accept the fact as many sensitive people do, that we live under all kinds of influences, of which the mind is a very important one.
Is there a science behind the power of the mind?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, we find, and we have found, George, for the past 150 years, really since the dawn of modern scientific clinical study, that our concepts of the mind constantly expand. They never recede. We don't even understand today what the placebo effect is, though we track it again and again over the course of literally thousands of trials for many years. In late 2010, there was a really groundbreaking placebo study done at Harvard Medical School where researchers gave people what was essentially a sugar pill, but they gave it to them transparently. They told them they were receiving an inert substance. They told them they were receiving something that wasn't a medicine. And a substantial number of people in this experiment still reported relief, even though they knew they were receiving what was effectively a sugar pill. And researchers were shocked because the placebo effect has basically rested in past research on some form of deception.
Yeah.
You think you're getting a real medicine, or you think you might be getting a real medicine. And these people felt better, even though they were told they were being given a completely inert substance. That blew the roof off of placebo research. You know, we're still trying to come to terms with things like this. So you find research like this across many different fields. And again, we are able to track scientifically what the effects of the mind are, even though we don't understand what the actual agency at work is.
How did you come to the conclusion that positive thinking does work?
Well, I came to it both from science and from personal testimony. First of all, the science in some respects is absolutely ironclad. We have so much research that's gone into what we call a placebo effect. And there are new fields of science emerging, like neuroplasticity, in which brain scans show that the patterns of our thoughts actually change the physical nature of our brains. And this is very recent research that's been used in some cases to treat obsessive-compulsive disorder and addictions. Then you have findings in 80 years of quantum physics, where researchers in labs discover that the presence of a conscious observer will actually alter the nature, the appearance, the manifestation of subatomic particles. So we are finding across a variety of different fields, medicine, brain biology, quantum physics, and various fields of psychology, including addiction recovery and treatment, an effect of the mind. So there's a body of science there that's growing and growing. And then you have a vast degree of personal testimony, and personal testimony can't be discounted. You have people who have extraordinary experiences where the tenor of their lives are turned around. They go through what might be called a spiritual awakening or a conversion experience when their thinking changes. There are many people who testify that they never would have been able to overcome drugs or alcohol if they didn't have a change in perspective. There was something about a change in perspective that produced absolutely objective results in their lives. And I looked at this and I thought, you know, we've been tracking this stuff in modern times for the past 150 years, and our conceptions of the mind have constantly expanded. They've never receded. It's just not reasonable to make a blanket dismissal of the positive thinking principle that our thoughts have causative properties. I just found it overwhelmingly persuasive that there is something there.
Of course, the opposite of positive thinking is negative thinking.
Yes, yes.
And that equally works, but in a different way, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And we can see that, you know, what we were just talking about earlier. Everyone in this society accepts that there are stress-related diseases, you know, whether it be hypertension or ulcers or chronic back pain, neck pain, in the absence of any organic malady. We see it all the time. And in a certain sense, it shouldn't even be controversial to say that, you know, thoughts have consequences. When we talk about stress-related diseases, we're speaking about the negative consequence of thoughts and emotions.
The research that you put into this book, how did your peers react to this?
How did my peers what? I'm sorry?
React to your work.
Oh, interesting. Well, you know, I'm just at the beginning of that cycle. I found a lot of people have been delighted and really thrilled because there are people who want to believe in the positive thinking thesis, but they're frustrated with a kind of victim blaming that can go on sometimes in positive thinking, where a sick person or a suffering person will be told that it's all in their minds, that their thoughts have caused them this problem. So interestingly enough, you know, I found a lot of people who have been very relieved to feel that there's someone saying, yes, positive thinking is legitimate, but it needs to be reformed. It needs to be changed. And I've also found that a lot of people have opened their doors and welcomed me, including the Christian Science Church, which is not a movement that sees itself as part of positive thinking, but it came from the same general culture in New England, transcendentalism, mental healing in the late 19th century. They were very open to me. They opened their archive to me. They welcomed me in, and I felt that they were able to help me with some really key research about where positive thinking came from. So I've really found like a very gratifying response among the various constituencies in the positive thinking world.
If somebody constantly thinks negatively, constantly, like the old producer, what happens to them?
Well, it's difficult to say because there might be a lot of factors going on in their lives. If they're at risk for a stress-related disease, they're probably going to hasten that disease. There are so many different factors that go into a human life, but if somebody constantly thinks negatively, I mean, on the very surface level, we know that not only are they going to be difficult to be around, but they're going to be the kind of person in the home and the workplace that people want to get away from. But the fact is, if we see so much evidence that a hopeful expectancy can have concrete results, as in the case of placebo studies, we have to be willing to at least consider the idea that a negative expectancy can cause some harm. I think the individual has to take care, has to be very careful with a chronic pattern of negative thoughts.
I think so too. Now, what about little children? I mean, you said you started this around 13 years old.
Yeah.
How does a little person start thinking positively, or are they born that way?
Yeah, that is one of the mysteries of human nature, because people will talk about conditioning and how important it is and such, but every parent knows that a child displays a personality right when they come out of the womb. I mean, it's absolutely extraordinary. I have two young sons, and they both had distinct personalities that were absolutely visible in those first moments when they emerged from the womb, and they've never parted from them. So we do have temperaments, and we come into this world with temperaments. But in a certain sense, that makes it all the more important. I mean, I think the first line of my book is, I have never thought positively by nature. And that's the truth. I am not naturally a cheerful, hopeful, optimistic person. I have worked to balance out the darker sides of my personality. And another time, you can ask my wife how well I have succeeded. But the very fact that we're born with a temperament makes it all the more important that these mental therapeutics become a part of our lives.
I think so, too, without a question. One Simple Idea, Mitch Horowitz. The book just came out, available, I would assume, all over the place.
All over the place. Amazon, your local bookstore, Barnes & Noble.
I think it's fun to change your life around if you're in a rut.
Yeah.
And, you know, books like this, Mitch, I think jumpstart people. If they really want to change, how many people actually want to change?
That's a beautiful question, and that's really the key ingredient, because these philosophies work to the extent that a person is absolutely starved for self-change, starved for self-change. There's an old Arab proverb that goes, the way bread smells depends upon how hungry you are. And that's a beautiful statement. And these philosophies are going to work or not work in a person's life based on how absolutely dedicated and committed they are. There's a story I tell in the book about Bill Wilson, the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous. Bill, at a certain point in his life, was able to stop drinking and never went back to it. One of his dear friends and collaborators, who brought Bill some of the spiritual ideas that saved him, was not able to stop drinking. And Bill's wife, Lois, wondered why. Why was one man able to quit and another man wasn't? What she concluded was, at least in that specific case, Bill wanted to quit with his whole soul. It was the purpose of Bill's life at that point to stop drinking. His friend wanted to stop, but he wanted to stop more to stay out of trouble. It wasn't his sole purpose. And when you want something with all your guts, something extraordinary happens. That, I think, is really the magic key. That absolutely wanting it with all your guts.
Mitch, do you think the ancients also did this? I mean, do you think like Jesus was a positive thinker? Must have been.
That's a wonderful question. The contemporary positive thinking folks like to refer back to ancient scripture and ancient sources, as we all do. You know, we like to feel that there's some sort of a ancient antecedent at our backs. There's not an uninterrupted line of thought between antiquity and between contemporary positive thinking, but you certainly do find in the Talmud, in the Gospels, and in certain ancient Egyptian Hermetic sources, the idea that the mind can open you up to extraordinary experiences. Every idea that's true has been thought by people all across reaches of time. So in that sense, I would have to say, yes, you do find examples of mental therapeutics in ancient sources, not just in scripture, but also in certain Hermetic manuscripts that came out of ancient Egypt.
Do you think science will one day take the position that this isn't physical at all? There's something else out there.
I think it will. There's such fierce debate that goes on over quantum physics, and, you know, psychical research has taken so many hits in this country since J.B. Ryan was alive. Psychical research has been attacked from so many different directions, even though the data that Ryan and Charles Honorton and some of the really outstanding psychical researchers, including scientists today like Dean Radin, even though their data has never been disestablished, has never been ably challenged. There are just these kind of, well, they would call themselves skeptics, I would call them cynics. There are these forces who don't want this to be a debate at all. They don't want to win. They don't want there to be any debate over whether there's an alternative to materialism. And so they'll challenge people like me when I talk about quantum physics, or they'll challenge people who run the Institute for Noetic Sciences, where they do wonderful psychical research. But the thing is, truth just keeps asserting itself. You know, you can chase it out the front door, it'll come in the back door. You know, you can push it out the bedroom window, it'll come in through the basement window. This research just keeps accumulating and accumulating and accumulating across a wide variety of fields. And eventually we are going to have a science that posits an alternative to materialism.
Absolutely. Mitch, stay with us. We're going to come back in a moment here on Coast to Coast AM and talk about your other work. One of your first ones, Occult America. That's an incredible story as well. And we're going to get into some of the history of magic. Last hour of the program, we will take your phone calls here on Coast to Coast AM. Hit another milestone in terms of numbers of people liking us on Facebook. So if you haven't done that yet, just go to our website, coasttocoastam.com. In the far right-hand corner, you can click that and just like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter, too, while you're up there. I'm George Norrie. Back in a moment, more with Mitch Horowitz. One Simple Idea and Occult America on Coast to Coast AM.